Peace Health Peace Harbor Medical Center presents Doc Talk, an informative health series educating our community on the services provided at Peace Health. We will begin with our host, George Henry, after these messages.
While the world around us is always changing, we stay focused on what matters. At Peace Health, we've offered hope, healing, and peace to Oregon Coast communities since 1989. Our care teams listen to your needs, take time to understand what matters to you, and treat you with the same respect and devotion that has guided us for generations. Peace Health, here for you today, tomorrow, always. Learn more at peacehealth.org. Peace Health believes communities grow stronger when everyone gets the care they need. That's why we've offered hope, healing, and peace to our neighbors on the Oregon coast since 1989. While change is constant, our promise to treat you with kindness and respect remains steadfast. Peace Health, here for you today, tomorrow, always. Find us online at peacehealth.org.
On the May edition of Doc Talk, it is Stroke Awareness Month, and I think we do this just about every year, kind of refresh folks on what it is and how it's preventable or how you can at least take the most precaution for it. Joining me today from Peace Health Peace Harbor Medical Center is Dr. Michael Wilder. And Dr. Wilder, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, thanks. George, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good, and hopefully we'll have a great Rhododendron Festival weekend. But other than that, let's talk a little bit about your background and your education. First off, what got you started in medicine? What was it when in school, whether it was elementary, middle, high, when did you say, I want to be a doctor?
Well, that sort of came later in life. I was actually, it was after undergraduate studies that I decided I wanted to go into medicine. I as a little kid, I'd sort of entertained the idea of becoming a pediatrician because we had this fantastic pediatrician when I was growing up, and so I wanted to be like him. But kind of put that to the side, and then it was always kind of on the back burner, and then just kind of had a light bulb moment where I realized, this is really what I want to do. And so went to medical school and then started neurology residency. Neurology was fascinating to me because of all the odd things that can happen when your brain doesn't function right. And it was very fascinating and just really complex. And it's something that we have kind of a basic understanding of, but there's just so much that we don't understand. Anyway, fascinating area. And then during neurology residency, I had this kind of interest in surgery, but really liked the problems in neurology. And then I realized that there's this field called neurointervention, which actually combines surgical procedures and neurology. Specifically, how I got interested in it was in the minimally invasive procedures that are available to treat patients who are having acute strokes. So I became aware of this early on in neurology residency and realized that this is what I wanted to do. And so after a neurology residency, I did further specialized training specifically in stroke. And then after that, did further training in neurointervention, which, as I mentioned, is the minimally invasive procedures where, among other things, we treat patients who are having strokes and treat patients who have aneurysms or carotid disease, all doing it through an eighth of an inch incision, either in the wrist or in the groin. So that is what I do now. Primarily is procedural, and so a lot of what we do revolves around taking care of patients who are at risk for having strokes or who have had strokes. And so it's a very fulfilling and an exciting and challenging field and rapidly evolving. So it's a very, very great place to be.
And we'll get a lot more into that too. But I'm curious, where did you go to medical school?
I went to medical school in New York at New York Medical College. and then did further training at the University of Utah. And after university, I stayed on faculty for a couple of years at University of Utah, and then went to University of Louisville in Kentucky, which was a fantastic education because Kentucky is in what is called the Stroke Belt. So there's this region of the U.S., kind of a belt that runs more or less through the South and the Midwest, where the rates of stroke are much higher than the rest of the country. And so so that was fantastic experience to be at University of Louisville in Kentucky. And then after that, had the opportunity to move out to the beautiful Pacific Northwest here. And I've been here just over 9 years and absolutely love it. So it's a wonderful place.
So
happy to be here.
So I can't tell for any accent or anything, but you said you went to New York, the university. Are you an East Coast person primarily, or did you migrate?
I am originally. I'm from Connecticut originally.
Okay.
I grew up there. And so lived all over the country though. And but like I say, this is I'm so lucky to be here now.
This is a great place to live, I gotta say. I think you agree, right?
Absolutely.
I'm talking with Dr. Michael Wilder. He is a surgeon and a stroke specialist at Peace Health, and we will be back with more on this edition of Doc Talk.
Peace Health believes communities grow stronger when everyone gets the care they need. That's why we've offered hope, healing, and peace to our neighbors on the Oregon coast since 1989. While change is constant, our promise to treat you with kindness and respect remains steadfast. Peace Health, here for you today, tomorrow, always. Find us online at peacehealth.org. While the world around us is always changing, we stay focused on what matters. At Peace Health, we've offered hope, healing, and peace to Oregon Coast communities since 1989. Our care teams listen to your needs, take time to understand what matters to you, and treat you with the same respect and devotion that has guided us for generations. Peace Health, here for you today, tomorrow, always. Learn more at peacehealth.org.
I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Michael Wilder at Peace Health. He's out of Riverbend, and we're talking stroke awareness. Let's get into some of the basics about that. You know, I think people think that strokes are mainly for older people in poor health conditions. But talk a little bit about how strokes can affect all ages, depending on in spite of age and health.
It's true. We tend to think of strokes as affecting older people, and the majority of our stroke patients are older, but it can affect people at any age. And so it's something that when we see a patient come in with an acute neurologic problem, who is young, for example, stroke may not be the first thing that we think about, but it's important to keep that in mind because it can happen at any age.
Now, is the younger folks, is that due to more genetic stuff than, you know, maybe what diet, exercise, and all this stuff? Because I know every now and then an athlete will come up with a stroke or something that someone deems as pretty physically fit.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, often in younger people, it's not the traditional risk factors. Traditional risk factors being high blood pressure, cigarette smoking, high cholesterol, diabetes, and then an abnormal heart rhythm called atrial fibrillation. Those are kind of the traditional risk factors. And in younger people, those are less common. But like you say, there can be genetic factors. But sometimes there can be injuries that can cause this too. So injuries to the blood vessels, say in a motor vehicle accident or something like that. Also, like you say, congenital heart conditions, so something that people are born with, that can happen too.
Now, you mentioned AFib and stroke. What are some of the reasons that AFib can cause or can contribute to stroke?
So atrial fibrillation is an abnormal heart rhythm where the heart is essentially not pumping efficiently. And so it allows blood clots to form within the heart. And then those blood clots can then move out of the heart and travel up to the brain and cause blockage of a blood vessel there, which causes a stroke or anywhere else. And, you know, they can, clots can travel anywhere else in the body from the heart. But so atrial fibrillation is a very big risk factor for the kind of stroke where you get a blockage of a large vessel. Atrial fibrillation can be tricky to diagnose, though, because it may sometimes just come and go and may not always be there. So sometimes it requires extended monitoring, you know, over the course of weeks or even months to detect it. But once it's detected, it is treatable, and the treatments are very effective in preventing stroke. And so it's a very important risk factor to be aware of and to treat.
So in that particular instance, does the blood tend to pool in an area and then kind of harden and form the clot and then go through the arteries?
Yeah, that's right. So when the heart is not pumping efficiently, the blood is not moving through the heart efficiently, and you can then the blood can coagulate, and then when you go back into a normal rhythm, which is typical with atrial fibrillation, is the AFib may come and go. So when you go back into normal rhythm, now everything gets pumped out, and so that's where you can be at risk for stroke.
Now, I think we've learned a lot about, you know, the different things that we can do to our body to not put us in the best health conditions. You mentioned smoking as one of them. How does smoking contribute to the negative effects?
Well, smoking is a big risk factor for something we call atherosclerosis, which is plaque buildup in blood vessels. And so that makes it a big risk factor for heart disease. And also for stroke. So it really negatively affects the health of the blood vessel walls and can allow for blockage of arteries in that way. So if somebody is a smoker, then by quitting smoking, they've significantly reduced the risk of heart attack and stroke.
And also, you referred to when you were in Louisville, you mentioned the stroke belt, which, you know, from living in Tennessee and North Carolina, we also known as the Bible Belt. There's kind of a, you know, a dual thing there. But I know the dietary proclivities of the group in that area. Lots of fats, lots of, you know, milks and butters and stuff like that. Is it dietary that makes that the stroke belt, or is it? Just a whole bunch of other things thrown together.
Well, it's probably a whole bunch of other things as well, but certainly diet is an important factor in stroke. And you know, we're really learning about how excess sugar in the diet is just, there's really no benefit to having the excess sugars, and in fact, probably a lot of detriment to having a lot of excess sugar. And of course, there's a lot of talk recently about processed foods and issues with that as well. But generally, when people ask me about diet, I recommend just avoiding those excess sugars, avoiding the processed foods, lots of vegetables. I think meat in moderation. But it is very important what we put into us in terms of keeping ourselves healthy.
Now, before the, what I'll call it, the 60s, the sugar revolution, you know, which where everything became processed with sugar and other chemicals and stuff like that. The consensus, I believe, say in the 50s, was that cholesterol around the 300 mark wasn't really a bad thing. Then the sugar came in there, and over the years, we've kind of dropped it to where, you know, we want to keep it around 100 or lower, something like that. How has that thought changed over that? Has it really been the processed foods and sugars more, say, than the fats? Not that the fats are great, but a bigger deal?
Well, I'm not really expert on diet, but I would say that there is probably, you know, there has been an emphasis on previously on how detrimental cholesterol and fats were, but it turns out that the body actually does need some fats and cholesterol. But I do think that the excess sugars are probably more detrimental. And if, you know, people want more information about that, we do have dietitians at Peace Health that can give more information about that. Because as I say, I'm not expert in diet other than in those basic things. Mm-hmm. Just trying to eat healthy.
Right. So let's talk about we mentioned the strokes. What are the different types of strokes?
So the most common type of stroke is called ischemic stroke. And ischemic stroke is where you have lack of blood flow to a part of the brain. And that's in distinction to a hemorrhagic stroke where you have bleeding into part of the brain. And so a hemorrhagic stroke, you can have bleeding in the brain because of a rupture of a blood vessel or an aneurysm, for example. But again, those are far less common than the ischemic stroke. Ischemic stroke essentially comes in two flavors. So again, the ischemic stroke is where you get lack of blood flow to the brain. So we referenced one type with the atrial fibrillation. So that's called a large vessel ischemic stroke. So when you have a clot that travels from the heart, for example, or sometimes a clot can travel from a diseased carotid artery up to the brain, those clots will tend to lodge in the bigger arteries in the brain and cause a fairly large stroke. So those are the kinds of strokes that we can take to the cath lab, which is where we do these minimally invasive procedures to remove the clots. So that's one type of ischemic stroke. The second type of ischemic stroke is called a small vessel stroke. And what this is it affects parts of the brain where the feeding arteries are very, very small. They're hair-like vessels measured on the order of microns. And these tiny little vessels are very susceptible to injury from high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes. And these little vessels can, when they're subjected to high blood pressure, for example, over time, they can actually thicken up. And they can thicken up so much that they actually just close off. They can pinch off. And then you get a small area of stroke from lack of blood flow. And that's called a small vessel stroke. Those kinds of ischemic strokes, there is really no treatment in the cath lab for where we run and remove a clot using the catheter. But both of these kinds of ischemic stroke can be treated with clot-busting medicine that's given through the vein. And so there is treatment for both of these, but as you and your listeners are probably aware, this requires treatment to start early on in the process of the stroke. So there's a time window in which to be able to deliver treatments.
What about the term aneurysm? Where does that come out? Does that have anything to do with the stroke process, or is that something totally different?
So an aneurysm can be associated with the hemorrhagic or the bleeding kind of stroke. So again, that type of stroke that's a lot less common than the ischemic stroke. An aneurysm is just a bulge or a sac on the wall of the blood vessel. And this sac can burst and cause bleeding into the brain. And that's called a ruptured aneurysm. And so those we treat in the cath lab too. We close those off to stop them from bleeding. But aneurysms are relatively common. A lot of people walk around, they have aneurysms in the brain, but the vast majority of them don't rupture. And so they're often discovered incidentally, where somebody gets a scan for, you know, dizziness or headache or something like that, and then we discover an aneurysm. So aneurysms are probably more common than we think, and they sometimes do rupture, and that's a type of hemorrhagic stroke.
I'm speaking with Dr. Michael Wilder. He's over at Peace Health Riverbend. We're talking about Stroke Awareness Month. When we come back, we'll talk about how to recognize a stroke and what to do when you feel like you're having one. We'll be back more on this edition of Doc Talk.
While the world around us is always changing, we stay focused on what matters. At Peace Health, we've offered hope, healing, and peace to Oregon Coast communities since 1989. Our care teams listen to your needs, take time to understand what matters to you, and treat you with the same respect and devotion that has guided us for generations. Peace Health, here for you today, tomorrow, always. Learn more at peacehealth.org. Peace Health believes communities grow stronger when everyone gets the care they need. That's why we've offered hope, healing, and peace to our neighbors on the Oregon coast since 1989. While change is constant, our promise to treat you with kindness and respect remains steadfast. Peace Health, here for you today, tomorrow, always. Find us online at peacehealth.org.
Dr. Michael Wilder is a stroke specialist over at Peace Health in River Bend and deals with a lot of our Florence residents here. It's Stroke Awareness Month. And now we're going to talk with Dr. Wilder about recognizing stroke. Dr. Wilder, what are some of the ways that you can see an onset, if you can find it before time or as it's happening? What kind of things do we need to look for or be aware of?
So stroke can look like a lot of things. Typically, it's rapid in onset. So it usually happens very fast. So typically doesn't sort of gradually come on. It's usually pretty sudden. And then there is an acronym that people should be aware of. It's FAST, F-A-S-T. And this helps you recognize sort of the basic signs and symptoms of stroke. So F stands for face. So facial droop. So if one side of the face goes droopy, that is a sign of a stroke. A stands for arm. And really this means arm or leg, but L doesn't fit in fast very well. So A, if your arm suddenly, one side is not moving. S stands for speech, so sudden difficulty talking. And then T stands for time, which means, again, that if we're going to deliver a treatment for this, we have a time window in which to do it. And so if you're experiencing any of these symptoms, call 911 right away. Again, because if there's something we can do for it, it has to be administered soon. And if you call 911, they bring in the ambulance, and then you don't wait in the emergency department. So don't drive yourself. Call 911.
Yeah, that's definitely the quickest way, because if they recognize that that's what's happening, they have some medications, too, usually on hand that they can help give for that.
Yes, and of course, when the ambulance is coming in, the emergency department gets the heads up that, hey, we have a potential stroke patient here. And then that sets off the whole system within the emergency department and the hospital, and we get alerts that this patient is coming in. And we have, we're leveraging technology to do this. We have actually an app that we use on, that the EMS has this particular app. We're on it as well. That is the emergency department. The CAT scan technicians are on this. The neurologist at the hospital is on this, the lab technicians who are going to draw blood, and then the cath lab folks, which is in where we do the procedures to remove the big clots. So when the EMS is picking up the patient, they get in on that app and they put in the info. And so everybody gets the alert that this patient is coming in, and we can see, you know, this is, for example, a 70-year-old male. He's last seen well an hour ago and now has a weakness on the right side of the body. His blood pressure is 150/90, and he takes the following medications. And so we all get this message, and then arrangements are made so that we can meet the patient when they arrive to emergency department. So that is why you want to come in by ambulance, and so that we get the heads up and can be there to deliver treatment.
Now, you mentioned your pretend patient was a 70-year-old male, which brings up another question for me. What about the ratio of men to women? Is this something that affects more men than women?
It's fairly equal, actually. Aneurysms, interestingly, are more common in women. But again, this is a pretty rare cause of stroke. In ischemic stroke, it's pretty well divided.
Now, you mentioned earlier about your work in neurology before, and I'm imagine that post-stroke, the neurology even comes more into light as far as, you know, patient recovery and that. And I imagine the quicker you get to a stroke, the less damage is potentially done. Tell me a little bit about how the neurology works post-stroke.
So post-stroke, when a patient gets the initial treatment, for example, the clot-busting medicine, or they go to the cath lab to have a clot removed, that's the beginning of it. And it's the whole post-stroke recovery is long. It takes months. But in the hospital, what happens is that a workup is done to try to find out why the stroke happened in the first place, so we can identify that problem and address it to prevent any more strokes from happening. And then all of the risk factors are looked at so that everything can be, quote unquote, tuned up. In the hospital, patients are evaluated by the therapy teams, who make recommendations on what sort of therapy is going to help the patient make the best and speediest recovery possible. And sometimes a patient is requires inpatient rehab afterwards, where they spend a few days or even a couple of weeks doing intensive therapies on the inpatient side. Sometimes a patient will do that as an outpatient. And sometimes patients, you know, the lucky ones really don't need much at all. But in addition to the rehab, there is the stroke recovery support groups that are really important for patients and families who take care of folks who've had strokes. You know, there are often a lot of changes that need to happen in order to take care of people after the stroke. So it's a long process, and there are multiple steps and services involved in helping these patients out.
Now, I don't know if this is a myth or not, and maybe you can dispel it if it is, but I've heard from some in the past that once you've had a stroke, you're more susceptible to more strokes. Is that the case, or does it depend on what you do after the first one?
Like you say, it depends on what you do after the first one. And so the key is to identify the cause of the stroke. And most of the time we can, but there are some patients where we're not 100% sure why they had the stroke. But if we can identify that, then that takes the risk of having another stroke really way down. So statistically, yes, you are at a slightly higher risk of having a second stroke. But if we can identify that risk factor, for example, we find the atrial fibrillation, then that really reduces the risk of having another one.
Now, you mentioned lucky patients that may not need a whole lot of post-stroke recovery. I've known some folks that have been severely debilitated by stroke, and then others that you know, that had some debilitation but were able to overcome that almost fully. Does that depend on the veracity of the stroke itself and how long it affected the body, or is it there are other factors involved?
Well, you know, stroke can affect any part of the brain, and so it depends what part of the brain is affected, really. So the way the stroke presents or manifests, and so the size of the stroke is important. How fast we can get to the stroke and deliver treatment is important, but also other factors too. So patients' overall health, other medical risk factors, they all play a role. So stroke can look, it's very heterogeneous, meaning, you know, some people have pretty mild effect or recover to almost no effect at all. And other people can have a pretty severe stroke and may have disability afterwards.
So it's interesting. You made a comment there, and I'm thinking about like gasoline in a car going through the fuel pump and then into the carburetor or the injection and stuff like that. And so when certain things happen, a mechanic can go through there and find out, you know, what it's going to affect based on that. But you mentioned that the stroke can affect different parts of the brain. And I'm wondering, scientifically, how does that happen? Because, like, when the blood's flowing to the brain, I imagine that it then goes off in many different directions as it hits the capillaries and things like that. Is that why we don't know exactly why it chooses what it chooses?
That's right. So you have multiple different blood vessels that feed the brain. And so depending on which blood vessel is affected, you get, for example, if the left side of your brain is affected by a stroke, then you might have language problems because most people's language centers are on the left. If you have left-sided stroke, you would typically have problems with movement on the right side of the body, so the opposite side of the body. A stroke to the brain stem can look quite different to that. So you might have eye movement problems, or you might have problems with balance or swallowing. And so it really just depends on what artery is involved and what part of the brain is fed by that vessel.
So obviously quitting smoking is a good idea. Getting rid of some sugars in your diet. What are some other things that people can do to help themselves, you know, try to avoid a stroke? I imagine exercises might be in there too, keeping your blood pressure low.
Absolutely. I think you hit them. So keeping your blood pressure well controlled, quitting smoking, exercising, eating well, sleeping well. If you have sleep apnea, get that treated because sleep apnea is a risk factor for stroke.
Really?
Following with your primary and making sure blood sugars and cholesterol are under good control. Those are all really important things. But lifestyle is very, very important.
So I'm going to make a correlation here and hopefully you can follow me along here. So is sleep apnea like the AFib for the heart and lungs? I mean, in a sense, because you're not, your breathing is changing, your breathing is sporadic.
Yeah, so...
I'm sorry, yeah, I mean, I know that's a weird way to go, but...
Sleep apnea certainly makes blood pressure much more difficult to control. And it disrupts your sleep, obviously, so you're not getting the restful sleep that you think you might be getting. This is one of those neat things. If you do have sleep apnea and you get treated for it, people say they say they feel a million times better. You know, they're less sleepy during the day. They're more alert. They just generally feel better. And so, it's a really, really cool thing to be able to treat that. Somebody who might have sleep apnea is somebody who snores a lot, and their partner says that they'll stop breathing at night momentarily. Headaches on awakening, daytime sleepiness. Those are all kinds of things that if you might want to talk to your primary care about if those are things that are affecting you.
One of the other things available, I mean, there's information always available for stroke and stroke awareness. Dr. Wilder, tell me a little bit about this new tele program.
So we are at Peace Health, we're setting up a telestroke network. And what that is it is a way to bring the stroke expertise from the from Riverbend to the places that don't necessarily have a stroke neurologist. So it's a virtual link where we have it's almost like FaceTime. So you have a video connection with the stroke expert at the what we call the hub hospital, and then you have say a patient comes into Florence, and at Florence they have a video connection that connects to the hub hospital and the expert. So the stroke patient comes into Florence, the connection is established over video and audio, and the stroke expert at Riverbend can then see the patient at Florence and talk to the patient, talk to family, and talk to the physicians who are taking care of that patient there in Florence. They can make recommendations and really get a jump start on any kind of treatment that needs to happen. This is something that we've been wanting to do for quite some time. We have gotten funding to do this, and we are excited to be rolling this out here in the next couple of months to our sister hospitals in Florence and Cottage Grove. The idea here is that this will improve our ability to provide cutting-edge stroke care to folks in more rural communities and ultimately improve outcomes.
All right. Dr. Michael Wilder is over at Peace Health Riverbend. He is a specialist in stroke, and we're talking stroke awareness this month. And what's really great is I've probably done a stroke awareness doc talk, you know, over the past 20 years, and I learn something new every time. And I guess that's because there's always changes, innovations, and things to know. So thank you so much for bringing us a wealth of information today.
You're welcome.
You have been listening to Doc Talk, presented by Peace Health Peace Harbor Medical Center. For more information on the program and services provided, visit peacehealth.org.